we on? Is there audio? I'm not getting audio.
We hear you. I hear you.
Oh, okay, perfect. Okay, very good. I was like, it's eerily quiet. Hey, Chris, welcome home. How was Washington, D.C.?
It was amazing.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
It was just so different from any prior trip. I've got to say, the RCRC side, I'd never worked so hard. It was just back to back to back. But, I mean, they were the top people, put you in the room with them, and were like, all right, have it out. What do you need? What do you want? So, like, Randy Moore, he's head fire chief for the whole U.S., to sit with him for an hour and just say, you got $5 billion to do prevention. What are you doing for Monterey? And him to say, here's some thoughts, here's some ideas, here's what we're doing. So they just put us in great rooms to have amazing conversations about even the infrastructure bill. They created under Buttigieg this entire focus on rural communities. And we qualify, and rather than talking at us, they were saying, tell us what you want. Tell us how to build this. What do you need? So it was just, you know, they were taking a ton of notes. It was just a different type of trip for me. It was really neat to see it from that side of it.
That's so cool.
And then it was fun to see the president yesterday and all the security protocols, and to be in that room and watch the whole process to have him speak in a room. It was really interesting when they lock the doors and say, all right, nobody else in or out. Then the dogs start running around. I mean, it was just fun and crazy.
Wow. You're back, though. You're not in D.C.
Got home at about 4:30 this morning. I was in the office by 9 o'clock, so it's been fun.
My gosh. Woo. Well, and I thought the life of an air pollution control officer was exciting.
You know, I'm no Richard Stedman.
Thank you for taking our voice and our needs out there, Chris. We really appreciate that.
Thank you, Wendy. Great. The VA conversation was amazing. We've got to have some more talks about that. That was also a really cool meeting with Brent.
Yeah, there's so much room there.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. Do we have a quorum here? 1, 2, 3, 7. I think we're good. Well, there we are. And there's Miss Sandy Brown. All right. Okay. Good. Well, this is a special meeting of the Monterey Bay Air Resources District. It is Wednesday, February 16th, 2022. And we'll go ahead and call this meeting to order. It's a single item agenda that we are looking at. And if I may, Rich, well, let's go ahead and just take roll. Sorry.
Ready?
Yep.
Director Brown, are you here?
Here, I am here.
Yes.
Hey.
Director Story.
Here.
Director Phillips.
Here.
Thank you. Director Eskew?
I'm here.
Thank you. Chair McShane?
Here.
Director Lopez?
Here.
Director Labar?
Present.
Thank you. Director Friend?
Here.
Vice Chair Coonerty? I think he's here. Vice Chair? Not yet. Okay. Director Carbone?
Here.
Director Kosamiki?
Here.
Okay. Director Coonerty? Not yet. Okay, we have quorum.
Great. Thank you very much, Siri. Well, as I think so many of us are familiar with AB 361 by now, Rich, would you like to just open this as a means of action?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. We're having the special meeting today to allow us to continue to operate by teleconference for our meetings for the next 30 days, including the meeting immediately following this meeting, hopefully. This is to be in compliance with AB 361, which lessens some of the requirements of the Brown Act for teleconference meetings. Specifically, we need to make two findings, or the board does, and one of which is that we're still operating under a proclamation or state of emergency from the governor, and that our Monterey County Health Officer has also recommended social distancing for all public meetings, and those two findings things are still true and correct. So without further ado, I'll leave it up to the board to make a motion and a determination that these findings are still in order and that we can proceed with teleconferencing for the next 30 days.
Great. Thank you, Rich. Let's see if there's any questions from board members. Seeing none, we'll just go to the public real quick. I think we're okay. So we'll go ahead and entertain a motion.
I'll move staff recommendation, Askew.
Thank you, Director Askew.
I'll second as well, Story.
Okay, so moved by Askew and seconded by Story. Will you call the roll, Siri? Yes.
All right. Director Story.
Aye.
Director Phillips.
Aye.
Director Brown.
Aye.
Director Askew.
Aye.
Chair McShane.
Yeah.
Director Lopez. Director Lopez.
Aye.
Thank you. Director LaBar.
Aye.
Director Kosamiki.
Yes.
Director Carbone.
Aye.
Director Friend.
Aye.
Director, Vice Chair Coonerty, are you here? Oh, did I hear you? Director Coonerty? Oh, no, absent. Approved.
Great, thank you very much. We'll just move on to the next item on this agenda, and that's public comment items not on the agenda. Public's welcome to comment. Just don't see anything. Anything received, Siri?
Nothing received at the district office.
Okay, seeing none, we'll go ahead and bring to closure the special meeting and adjourn that and then come back to convene for our regular board of directors meeting. So don't everybody blink at once. There we go. So yes, it is February 16th, 2022, and this is the regular board meeting for the Monterey Bay Air Resources District. Siri, will you go ahead and call the roll?
Yes, I will. Directors Brown.
Still here.
Thank you. Director Story.
Yes, here.
Director Kosamiki.
Here.
Director Coonerty.
Here.
Director Carbone.
Here.
Director Friend.
Here.
Director LaBar.
Present.
Director Phillips.
Here.
Director Askew.
Here.
Director Lopez.
Here.
Chair McShane.
Here.
Oh, we have quorum. Everyone's present.
Great. And I failed to acknowledge our Pledge of Allegiance. Okay. Director Brown, will you lead us? There's got to be a flag around here someplace. I know we've got one here. Whenever you're ready.
I will. I'm going to try to stand here as I do this. You can still see me. Okay, I'll get us started here. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, under God, with liberty and property for liberty and justice for all. I'm so sorry. I'm out of practice. We haven't been doing it in our city council meeting. So
not to put you on the spot. No, it's all good. And
very
great to have you.
Yes, thank you.
Sure. And I guess that's a good segue just to welcome you. You were on this board, I think, at one time.
Yes.
Yeah. So do you want to just say hello to everybody? Welcome to.
Sure. I'd love to. I am Sandy Brown. I represent the city of Santa Cruz. I'm a city council member and represent the city of Santa Cruz on MBARD. I was previously on the board. I love this board. I love the work. I love the staff, and I'm really happy to be back. I'm taking over for council member Golder, who is her schedule has gotten very tight in her new role as a principal of Bayview Elementary School. And so hearing her on and have agreed to return. And I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you.
Well, welcome. We're lucky to have you. Our next item on the agenda is election of our board chair and vice chair for 2022. We had a nominating personnel and budget subcommittee meeting prior to this and discussed, and there is a slate to present that. I will introduce Ms. Marianne Carbone.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve. So we had met earlier, and through discussions, due to the pandemic and to keep a seamless leadership here going, we decided to recommend for chair Director McShane and for vice chair Director Coonerty. So in other words, to keep the officers the same for another year.
Okay. Thank you. Would any other budget or personnel or nominating committee members like to comment on that?
I'll jump in and just share, you know, we were talking about the process in order to change over paperwork, to get signatures, to change accounts for signing checks, doing that whole rigmarole. And given where we stand now, our first item on the last agenda was also 361 to keep us remote. And given all of that, it kind of felt like continuing down the path we're going right now would be a little more simple. And so if that was where it came from. I did bring up that topic in the conversation, so I wanted to share those thoughts for the full board.
Thank you. Welcome back. And congratulations, Director Coonerty. Okay, so just any comments or questions at this point before we go to the public on this? Yep, Director Askew.
Yeah, thank you. I was just curious, from a process standpoint, do we typically rotate through the three counties? Is there any formal or informal protocol about ensuring that we have that rotation in place?
Yeah, that was brought up, and it's not specified in our bylaws, though that has been in the practice in years past. It's been off and on, I mean, in my experience.
Okay. So I guess my only question would be for anyone from San Benito County, this would put off a year of leadership for San Benito, and just want to make sure everyone is comfortable with that.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yeah, by all means.
Yeah, I'm comfortable with that. I think just... Looking at next year, I understand we're in a pandemic, but I think if we can just from a reasonable standpoint, San Benito for next year would be great.
That's good. Fair. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Well, let's go to the public real quick here. I don't see any hands raised. Siri, anything received?
Nothing received at the district office.
Okay, we'll come back for a motion then.
I'd move the slate recommendation.
Thank you. Is there a second? Okay, moved by Phillips, seconded by Labar. Siri, will you call the roll?
Yes, sir. All right. Director Kosumiki.
Yes.
Director Carbone.
Yes.
Director Friend.
Aye.
Director Labar.
Aye.
Vice Chair Coonerty.
Aye, reluctantly for the vice chair, but I'll live with it for a while. Yeah.
Director Lopez.
Aye.
Director Askew.
Aye.
Director Phillips.
Aye.
Director Story.
Aye.
Director Brown.
Aye.
Chair McShane.
Yes.
Passed unanimously.
Thank you, Siri. Well, with that and the enthusiasm we have for the agency, we have a couple of recognitions at this time. Certainly outgoing member Jack Dillis. I don't think he's on, but I know he was very thoughtful, very engaged, and we prepared a plaque that we will get to him as appropriate. Rich, anything you'd like to add to that?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Let me see if I can share my screen. I have the proof of the cutting boards that we're going to distribute.
Does it come with a knife?
There is no knife.
Okay.
Can folks see that? Or
whoa. Oh, there we go. Oh, yeah. And so, we have outgoing Jeff Davis from the advisory committee. Okay, good. Right.
So we've decided now, which is better than having a piece of glass or something to hang on the wall, although you can hang these on the wall, but they can also do double purpose as a cutting board. So you'll see that Jax is there, and we'll be getting to that. I think it's been sent in the mail already. Jack just wanted me to say that he thoroughly enjoyed his tenure here on the board and highly values the good work that MBAR does. He's really sorry to be stepping off the board. I think he'd still like to be on. So with that, we certainly will salute him, and his name will live on forever on our brass plaque outside the boardroom. So he at least has a part of that history as well.
Awesome. Thank you. And with that, a good segue to that other terrific plaque with truly one of our best, and that's Alan Romero. And how appropriate that there's a Tesla on it. When I think of Teslas, I think of Alan Romero, you know, early adopter and advocate. Alan, I know you're with us. So how about a few great words as we recognize you and your service to the district?
Thank you very much, Director McShane, and hello, all of the MBAR directors. I really do miss being there. It's been wonderful 13 years. It's been an honor to be in public service to the public as an air quality planner. And I wanted to just share quickly one thing real quick, but I think which Rich will appreciate. This was wonderfully dropped on my door this morning. Come on, camera. Do your magic. There it is. So that showed up this morning, and it just made my day. Oh. It really made my day. So thank you very much, Board of Directors. This is my 7th week of retirement. I'm enjoying life immensely. Got to sleep until 7 this morning. Did my yoga class at 10. Let me see. I just kind of goofed around after that. And I think tomorrow I'm going to go paddling.
Yeah, back to more goofing around. I love it, Alan. Congratulations. Let's give him a round of applause. Thank you for your service and your work. Thank you very much, Alan. Well, we just really commend you. Thank you. And with that, we'll move on to our next item on the agenda, and that's public comment. Items not listed on the agenda. Members of the public are invited to comment. Just looking very quickly here. I don't see anybody. Siri, anything?
Nothing received at the district office.
Okay, great. So then we'll move on to just quick reports. The Budget Personnel Nominating Committee did meet. We took action on recommendations for mid-year budget adjustments. And that's about that. And, Rich, do you want to comment on the advisory committee?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. The advisory committee did meet this month. We received an excellent presentation from Heather Adamson, who's the director of planning over AMBAG on SB 375 for our sustainable community strategy. We also received a presentation on the district semi-annual monitoring data, which you'll be receiving today as well, and as well as the engineering and compliance activities for year 2021. And then the advisory committee also received a presentation and commented on the electric bicycle incentive program and electric vehicle incentive program, low income criteria. So that's before you today as well, with their input and comments. And then they also received a report and provided comments on evaluation of best available control, a retrofit control technology, or what we call BARCT, and potential rule revisions to our rule 2427, which is steam-driven crude oil production wells, or creation of a new rule. And you'll be hearing that as well today. And that concluded our discussion topics. We will be meeting next month as well to go over some additional items. So specifically the AB 2766 allocations.
Great, okay. Well, thank you. Any questions from board members regarding either the Budget Personnel Nominating Committee meeting or just the report from the advisory committee? Seeing none, going quickly to the public here. I don't see anything received, Siri?
Nothing received at the district office.
Okay, thank you. So we'll move on to comments or referrals from any of the board. Next week, I'm joining Director Phillips for a tour of the Vistra facility in Moss Landing. This is it's a gas-fired plant, but it's also a plant that's in major transition, to ultimately become one of the largest battery storage facilities in the West Coast, as I understand it. So that might be really neat, and it might be something good for other directors interested in the subject to consider at some point as well. Anything else? No, okay. Okay, so moving on to Rich's report.
Thank you, Chair McShane, members of the board. I'll try to get through this, not too much, but in engineering, last month we received delegation from the US EPA for our new source performance standards and national emission standards for hazardous air pollutants. This allows us to implement and enforce federal regulations. There's a number of them, but I won't go through them all, but it's basically combustion engines and turbines and the standards that the feds have for those. I'm really happy to welcome a new engineer on our staff. His name is Fernando Pena. He started with us on January 10th. Fernando received his BS degree in chemical engineering from Cal Poly Pomona. He has an MS degree in environmental engineering from Cal State Fullerton and an MBA from Cal State Dominguez Hills. Fernando has engineering experience in wastewater treatment and oil drilling and has served as a chemist for an electronic manufacturing company. So he comes to us very well-rounded. He's hit the ground running. He seems like a really great guy. He's got a great attitude, and we're really pleased to have him here. One of the standing items I have is the marina odor complaints. I'm not happy to say that we received over 20 odor complaints from marina residents between December 18th and February 9th. We followed our protocol, which is to send an email each time we received a complaint. We send that out to the Monterey Regional Waste Management District, Monterey One Water, Keith Day Composting, the agricultural operator, and Monterey County Environmental Health. In addition, Amy Climo and I met earlier this week with Felipe Melchor, who is MRWMD's new GM. So we sort of let him know. We've got a lot of other things going on at the landfill, so we wanted to let him know that we're here to collaborate and assist wherever they may need it. They have a lot of environmental challenges at the landfill, and we really want to work together and not get in an enforcement stance out there. So that's new there. I think that Felipe and others will be meeting with the city of Marina to discuss odor allocation attribution study that may be happening this year. In planning and air monitoring, we have another new staff I'm really proud to introduce. His name's Eddie Balleron. He's our new air monitoring specialist. He studied locally at UCSC, where he received a BA in Earth Science, Anthropology, and an MS in Earth and Environmental Sciences. Prior work, he was a senior technician and project manager at Advanced Environmental, a consulting firm up in San Jose. And he's got a lot of experience in industrial hygiene and air monitoring. So he brings a wealth of experience and also a really good attitude. He seems like a really great guy, and we're really pleased and happy to have him here. Moving on to the our wood stove changeout program, we've allocated the entire $87,500. 62 applications are in the process. They've been approved. So we're working now to get those changed out. In case those fall off the list, we have a backup list, a waiting list that folks can get on. Unfortunately, we only had four low-income applications with those. It's not surprising. It's getting, folks that don't own their own home are sort of not really interested in changing out. Or if they are, they've got to get the owner of the home to agree to change the stove out. So we're going to try to look at different ways to approach that so we can get some of the more low-income folks changing their stoves out. Our Monterey Bay Electric Vehicle Incentive Program is chugging along. We've processed about 154 applications, nine of which are low income. We hope to get more there as well. And just like the wood stove, we double the incentive amounts for low income qualified applicants. So we've got about 212,000 obligated, and with remaining about $238,000. So we're about halfway, or a little bit more than halfway. So we're going to make a big push to get the word out and also talk about stacking opportunities with 3CE as well as the state CVRP program. I get tied up with my acronyms too, so I need a cheat sheet. So our San Lorenzo Valley Spare the Air program is in operation. I'm happy to say that we have not had to call a Spare the Air voluntary reduction at this time due to deteriorating air quality conditions. We haven't had that many inversions, but that will happen if we do see stable air conditions that will result in increased concentration of pollutants at the ground level. And then a few last things. So the press is reporting that EPA, and this was yesterday, so hopefully it's already been done, but EPA will reinstate the waiver of federal preemption for GHGs and ZEV components, zero emission vehicles, for California's Advanced Clean Cars program, clearing the way for the state to implement and enforce those standards, and for other states that adopted those standards under the Clean Air Act to implement those as well. So we're really happy to be able to say that we're getting back and leading the way for not only the nation, but probably the world in California for clean air technologies and zero emission vehicles for mobile sources. And then lastly, I just want to say, although it was discussed in our Budget and Personnel Committee meeting, I'm really, really pleased to announce that we're fully funded with respect to our liabilities for our OPEB account. And that is in large part due to the investment strategy that we chose initially. We've been able to fund that program. And so going forward, we'll be putting in a modest amount to maintain that, as our actuary tells us the specific contributions we need to make. Next month, I will try to get PARS representatives to come before the committee, as well as the full board, to discuss, once again, investment strategies. Our retirement pension account strategy is a conservative one. Our OPEB strategy was moderately conservative, so we did really well. We beat the predicted 7% by far with the OPEB account. We're sort of around 4 or 5% with our other strategy, which is more conservative. So we'll have the opportunity, they'll talk to us, and if we want to change strategies, considering what the market conditions may be in the future, which nobody really knows, but they've got some good ideas, I'm sure they'll be happy to report that to you. So with that, that concludes my remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Rich? Seeing none, just quickly going to the public, see if there's any comments on the APCO's report. Don't see any. Siri, anything received?
Nothing received, sir.
Okay, thank you, Rich. We'll move on to the consent agenda. We have five items on the consent agenda. Would anybody like to pull an item from the consent agenda? Okay, seeing none, just going to the public. Let's see anything. Okay. Any comments?
Lopez, I'll move consent.
Thank you. Okay. Is there a second?
Phillips, second.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. Will you go ahead and call the roll, Siri?
Well, yes, sir. Director Story.
Aye.
Director Phillips.
Aye.
Director Lopez.
Aye.
Director Askew.
Aye.
Director Carbone.
Aye.
Director Kosamiki.
Yes.
Director Brown.
Aye.
Director Labar.
Aye.
Vice Chair Coonerty.
Aye.
Director Friend.
Aye.
Chair McShane?
Yes.
Passed unanimously.
Thank you. Okay, so let's start with our first item on the regular agenda, and that's a presentation from our very own David Frisbee.
Good afternoon, Chairman McShane, members of the board. I'm David Frisbee, Planning and Air Monitoring Manager here. I'm going to share my screen with you. And I'll start the slideshow. So today I'm going to present the monitoring results for 2021. So the Air District operates seven air monitoring stations throughout the region. There's an additional air monitoring station that has been operated by the Pinnacles National Park for many years for visibility purposes. They've got visibility requirements from the federal government. That coincidentally happens to be the highest concentration readings that of ozone in the region. So our air monitoring stations, we've got all of them measure ozone with the exception of San Lorenzo Valley and San Juan Bautista. PM2.5 is measured at all of the stations with the exception of Pinnacles National Park and San Juan Bautista. And PM10 is measured at San Juan Bautista, Hollister, and King City. These are a couple of examples of our air monitoring stations. They're portable structures that house the air monitoring equipment in order to just keep them out of the weather. We've got sample ports that go out of the buildings to draw samples into the equipment. We also have meteorology stations at each of the air monitoring stations. This is an internal shot of our air monitoring stations. We've got on the left an instrument rack. That's our ozone monitor. The middle picture is our instrument rack. On the backside, you can see at where the samples are drawn in and then they're conditioned before they enter the equipment. On the right side is a particle monitor that we have for our PM2.5 program. That's funded by EPA through our 103 grant. We measure and monitor the air quality around the region for the purpose of seeing if we're within the ambient air quality standards for California and the national standards. Each of the standards have averaging periods and then appropriate concentrations, correlating concentrations for each of the averaging periods. The California standards tend to be stricter than the national standards. We've been in attainment for all the national standards for a number of years now. California standards, we are in attainment now for all the standards except for PM10. Ozone, we were determined to be in attainment for the ozone standard at the in 2020 by the Air Resources Board. That's over a three-year period from 2017 through 2019. And the last 2 years, we've also stayed in attainment for the California standard, which is a big accomplishment. So these are the air monitoring results for the hourly peak ozone. The standard is this dark bar across the chart at 90 parts per billion. So you can see for each of the air monitoring stations for each of the counties, we are well within attainment for the 1 hour averaged ozone. For the 8 hour average ozone, the standard is the 70 parts per billion. That's represented by this black line here. You can see that for each of the counties, we are, at least for Santa Cruz and Monterey, we're well within attainment. And in San Benito County, we're coming right up on the edge of the standard. We didn't exceed it, so we're in attainment for another year. But you can tell that by this blue line, Pinnacles tends to get right up next to the standard still. For PM2.5, which is about the size that we see in smoke, the federal standard. There's no, there is not an, a state standard for PM 2.5, but for the federal standard, which is 24-hour average, is represented by this black line here. For all of our permanent stations, we are well within the standard. For the our seasonal stations, we do we install three seasonal stations in the San Lorenzo Valley every year between October and April. And that's to measure wintertime smoke from wood stoves and fireplaces and open burning. And you can see that we had 2 days where we exceeded, and those were both at the Boulder Creek Fire Station. The one in January was likely due to wood smoke, and the one in December was likely due to the fire district has a warming fire for their Christmas tree sales that they do at that time of year. So for PM 10, this is one of our areas that we tend to exceed the standards pretty regularly. We see most of our exceedances down in King City. We had 12 exceedances this year in King City, 5 in Hollister, and 1 at our new station in San Juan Bautista. We added a station at the San Juan Bautista Elementary School back in March as a result of having a high, it took only one high reading at the Hollister station above 80% of the standard, of the national standard, and that required us to install a new station. So we did exceed 80% of the standard again in, looks like in October. And that was due to a high wind event that we saw that lasted most of the day. It came from the north-northwest. And this the 12 days actually is represents quite a bit fewer days than we've seen historically. We've, for many years, we used to see about 30 to or more exceedances of PM 10 standard, this black line here in King City during much of the summer and fall. And so we're seeing a pretty significant reduction there as well. This is our new smoke sensor. It's a company called Clarity makes these sensors. They measure PM 2.5. So we've purchased a number of these sensors and installed them around the three counties in order to measure wildfire smoke. So the intention was to get a sensor at each of the municipalities in the district and an additional monitors in the unincorporated areas where there might be higher populations. These also serve to measure PM 2.5 in disadvantaged communities and low-income areas per our Community Air Protection Program grant. And we're also looking at using these to replace our seasonal network in the San Lorenzo Valley. They're ideal sensors for our purposes. They don't need any line power. They've got a solar panel, battery pack, and so they're totally self-contained. All the data is sent to us via a 4G modem, as you can see with the antenna there. They're super easy to install. You just put them up against a wall. You register them on your on your phone and walk away, and they end up on a map that we share with the community. And so we have, I believe, about 17 of them out now. We intend to get about 30 total installed throughout the region. And so we'll be prepared for the next wildfire. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Very helpful. This was great. Thank you very much, David. Let's just look to, you can stop sharing screen. We'll just look to the board, or well, if we need to get to a slide, I'm not sure, but I can't see everybody. Let's see here. Maybe that'll work a little better. But yeah, any questions for Mr. Frisbee? This is not an action item. Okay, we'll quickly go to the public. And I don't see any at this time. So we can thank Mr. Frisbee for his presentation. And move on to our next item, which I lost my agenda there, shucks. I'm full screen right now. There we go. Wait, hang on. Bear with me. Okay, so we'll go on to our next item, which is item 17, and that's a presentation and guidance on our low-income criteria for our e-bike incentive. Back to Mr. Frisbee.
Thank you, Chairman McShane, members of the board. Yeah, we're seeking guidance from the board because we've had low participation with our incentive programs. And we believe that it's due to the eligibility requirements that we have for low income and how we determine that low income. So I'll go through that with you now. Mm-hmm. Just to remind you, we've got two programs, the electric vehicle incentive program. And we also have the bicycle incentive program. So light duty vehicle incentives, we have for all electric vehicles, $1,500. And then for the other categories, we have got a range of incentive amounts. And for the electric bicycle incentive, we offer $1,000 for a bicycle priced between $1,000 and $4,000 purchased from a local bike shop. Our current status is that we have had four applications for the electric bicycle incentive program since it opened on September 28th. So it's really been very slow. Out of 154 applications for our electric vehicle incentive program, we've had 9 applications come in, and not all of them actually qualified once they they applied. So I think we have more like 5 that are actually getting the double incentive for the electric vehicle incentive program. This is not for lack of trying. We've advertised in newspapers, online, our website, social media, bike shops, and an outreach event with Ecology Action earlier in the year, or late last year. So our incentives that we have for these programs, electric vehicle program is double the incentive amounts. So $1,500 for a all electric vehicle would be $3,000 for low income. The electric bicycle incentive program is only open to low income applicants. And currently we use Central Coast Energy Services to verify income for us. And this is free to the district because they are already checking eligibility for the low income heating energy assistance program. They do that. They like to support us with this because it brings in more applicants for their services. And we like it because it avoids issues with us having to review and store personal records. But for applicants, it's an added step and a complication for them. So the LIHEAP eligibility is based on monthly income. The limit for what a single person household would be $2,564, and that's about $31,000 a year. And it increases by the number of people in the family or in the household. There's many other low-income programs available. There's HUD and CARE, WIC, and SNAP. So there's many that are available that people are already qualified for. And just to give some examples of the eligibility for these programs, you can see that for HUD, which is also Section 8 housing, it's for assistance for various communities in our region. It's based on median income and fair market rents. So the area median income for each of the counties is how its eligibility is determined. So if you look at the lowest eligibility limit would be in San Benito County, that's $54,700, which compared to the LIHEAP was almost $31,000. So it's much more it would give much better eligibility for people in our region if we went with the 80% area median income. Monterey County is a little higher at almost $57,000. And Santa Cruz County is a whopping $78,000 per year as 80% of the area median income. Monterey County also has United Way, so which is based on the county area median income. Medi-Cal bases their eligibility on percent of the poverty level, the federal poverty level. So, you know, depending on the program, and the number of people in the household, they base on the percentage of the poverty level, which is that poverty levels for a single person household is $12,000, almost $13,000. And going up to 400% would be, you know, $51,000 a year. Whereas LIHEAP is at 31,000. So CARE is less. This is just for an example. It's 34,000, almost 35,000 per one-person household. Our friends at Central Coast Community Energy, their incentive programs are based on eligibility is based on any of these programs as well. So it's just a list from their website.
Mm-hmm.
So our recommendations for low-income eligibility would be to accept any of the federal, state, local, or other similar low-income programs with a required proof of active enrollment through a letter or a certificate instead of relying on Central Coast Energy Services. And we recommend this for both electric vehicle incentive program and the electric bike incentive program. Our advisory committee, they supported the staff option to use other low-income programs to determine low-income eligibility. They also voted unanimously to recommend opening the program up to purchases from bike shops outside of the district. So that's their recommendation to the board.
Okay.
We did have one public comment. On our Instagram, I guess, or tweet, rather Twitter account, that was recommending to broaden the criteria for establishing low-income qualifications.
Wow.
And with that, glad to take any of your comments or questions.
First time I ever seen public comment via Twitter. That's impressive. Let's see, I saw Rich had his hand up. Rich, do you just want to comment before we go to Director Kosmicki and Director Labar?
Yeah, sure. I just want to say that although the committee voted and made that recommendation about opening it up to local, beyond local bike shops, it's been our experience that that's not the limiting factor here for qualifying. The limiting factor really is how we determine the low income. We've heard nothing but praise from the local bike shops and to the board for making the determination that they want to see the money stay within our area. We've been toying also around with the quality bikes. There's now a UL listing for electric bikes, which will hopefully protect the customer from electric shock hazards, as well as apparently there've been a lot of fires with lithium batteries in charging up some of these electric bikes. So the UL listing would do a lot. We still don't recommend, you know, having people go down to Kmart or I shouldn't use a store name, you know, but a big box store and buying an electric bike that's only a couple hundred dollars because we think it's going to be a solid waste problem down the road. We want to make sure bikes are serviceable. And we had staff here that experienced this. Their bike came apart. They bought one mail order and the company said, yeah, we'll fix it, send it back to us. And the shipping charges alone were probably as much as the bike cost. Wow. So they took it to a local bike shop. Fortunately, it wasn't an electronic issue. It was just they had to rebuild the wheels on the bike. So, you know, we're seeing this anecdotal evidence that, you know, we think we're pretty right. I think the community power is a free game. So anything you want to do, they're hoping to do it. But, you know, once again, as we've said repeatedly, we don't have really good evidence that this is actually doing a lot for cleaning the air. And I think it fits well within 3CE's business model, though, because they start getting more chargers out there and people using their product. So, but you know, we'll do what the board deems important, but those are our recommendations. And we certainly do think that allowing to use more low income avenues will help the program immensely. Lastly, I'll just say that the COVID-19 has not helped the situation at all. Supply is really low. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we've heard too, this is once anecdotal evidence that a lot of the manufacturers, the automobile manufacturers, as well as bikes, are charging a lot more for their products now because of the scarcity. So it sort of negates some of the incentives that we're offering. So we hope to get back to normal so we can start, you know, giving real incentives to the public to buy down the cost of these technologies.
Thanks, Rich. Yeah. Thanks. Let's go to Director Kosmicki.
Yeah, thank you. I had a couple questions. I was a little confused on the graphic of the 9 when you were talking about electric vehicle applications. And what's the 9 and what's the 154?
Oh, that was 154 applications. We received 154 applications for the electric vehicle incentive program. That's to help people purchase an electric vehicle. And nine, we received 9 applications of that. And then of those 9, we actually, we only were able to get about 5 applicants that
So 154 was applications, and then you said total. 9 was applications. So
total applications, both low income and non.
Okay. So 9 is the low income.
Yeah.
Okay. And then as far as the bikes, are we talking? You showed a 50% AMI and a 80%. So we're going to potentially expand to 80% then.
That's right.
Okay, I just want to make that clear. Is there anything precluding us from removing the low income? I hate to bring this up, but removing the low income aspect of this, if we're really trying to get these bikes and vehicles out there and trying to reduce carbon emissions, just curious on that.
So with the electric bicycle program could be opened up to anybody, regardless of income. The electric vehicle incentive program has,
it already does. Yes. So I guess my kind of gut on this is that electric bikes are really a non-essential for people. You know, a car, you really car for the most part around here, the bike, you know, I feel like, it might be worth discussing whether to just remove the low income barrier on the bike part of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go to Director Labar, and then we'll go to Director Askew.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. So I had a couple comments. One is on electric bikes. I do not believe we should open it up beyond the Tri-County area. So I wouldn't be for that. The online, I think Rich stated correctly. We would have to be very particular on the online sellers, I believe. For me, I went through and looked at the application process to verify low income. It is cumbersome. So I would be more in favor of keeping it for the low income, do some modifications, see what works. And if we don't get an increase of low income individuals, then what Director Kosmicki said, open it up, I think would be the next logical step. I would have a concern on the 80% where, and I understand Santa Cruz is much higher, much costlier, but to keep an eye on the distribution. So Santa Cruz 80% is 40% more than San Benito and Monterey. And if we start seeing an influx of applications from there, we might want to look more of a standardized number. So it's more equal based because I think low income is low income. Definitely open up the eligibility for qualifying for low income, I think would be a much more helpful way to do it. And if that doesn't get those numbers up, then you just open it up full on to anybody that applies. And then maybe you do the the double, like we do on electric vehicle, you double the amount if they provide the verifications. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Labar. Director Askew?
Yeah, thank you. And I just want to, again, I think this is, it's a brand new program, right? And we're one of the first to offer incentive programs for e-bikes. And so just acknowledging that it's going to take a little time to figure out what this, what's right about, you know, how to make it work. So really just, I appreciate the willingness to engage in the ongoing conversation. I think I did have a question about stacked incentives. Are there stacked incentives, and are we advertising with those stacked options?
Yeah, I can take that through the chair. So yes, we have let folks know there are stacked options, so people can go to 3CE as well as us to get monies. They don't obviously, it would only be low-income people that qualify through us that could get the options with 3CE, but they're offering, I believe, they're doubling the amount for low-income at 3CE, plus if you buy from a local bike shop, they give an additional, I think it's a $100 incentive, so they're trying to gear people towards local shops, but yeah, we've made a number of, we put out a number of press releases about stacking availability for vehicles, including the bicycle program.
Thank you.
Okay, and do you know what the amount is for the 3CE e-bike? The amount for the 3CE e-bike?
I think it's $450.
$400? I think something like that. It's under $500.
Okay, and then the other question. So I guess I'm comfortable. I think we just need to keep, like, you know, figuring out where the right audience is. I am comfortable opening up eligibility. I think that, you know, if you're low income and you really are low income, like having that discretionary income to go buy a bike is not always something that you've got available to you. I'm supportive of maintaining the limit on local bike shops. I think that's one thing where we can, you know, support our local economy. If opening up eligibility, as Dr. Labert said, doesn't, and maybe pushing out some more very targeted information to those who are eligible, if that doesn't work, I don't see any reason why we wouldn't open up eligibility and take away the low income requirements. We don't have a low income requirement for the cars. And I think that if someone's willing to ride a bike back and forth to work, that we should be supporting that as an alternative option, regardless of their income. They don't generate more emissions because of how much money they earn. So if our goal is really to get people out of their cars and to improve the bike infrastructure. And I think just a final point, you know, the more the bike infrastructure, the safety of bike infrastructure is dependent on the number of people who are utilizing that infrastructure on a bike. And so on some level, we've done a ton of work to try to create bike infrastructure within our communities, some communities more than others, and especially those that are more dense, more than others. But the safety of that infrastructure is only as good as the number of people who are using it. So there is this tension that exists, and the more people that we can encourage and incentivize to get onto a bike to use the infrastructure, the safer it's going to be for everyone. And we are making very intentional plans and investments throughout other places, through Safe Routes to School, through TMZ, through city investments, to make that happen. And this is, I think, an important part of supporting that larger body of work. So those would be my suggestions and thoughts.
Thank you, Director Askew. Director Labar, do you have your hand back up, or are we good?
No, I did have my hand back up.
Yep. Okay.
Oh, and I understand exactly what you're saying, Wendy. My only concern is at this point in time, if we open up the eligibility to anyone, then those who are already buying the bikes because they can afford them will get them at a discount. And I'd rather try another attempt to make sure low income first by raising that dollar amount. Oh, I must have misunderstood. Because I want the low income to have that thing. And by moving at 80%, I think and making it easier to qualify. Because I will tell you, I felt that was a stop point for me when I started that. And having other eligibility mechanisms, I think, is key. But if
I'm totally on the same page as you, Mike.
Okay.
Yeah,
then, 100%. Yeah, if that doesn't work, we should look at this in 6 months. And then if it doesn't work, model it after the electric vehicle program. If you're low income, you get twice as much. Thank you. Sorry, Wendy.
Yep. Let's just bring it back to Rich. And then I just want to make sure David has enough direction. It sounds like there's agreement with staff. And then ultimately this idea that it be opened up potentially. Rich?
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't remind the board that, you know, we were hoping to generate data. We have no data whatsoever that this is going to be taking vehicles off the road. It stands to reason that somebody who purchases these one may, but we have no requirement that they, you know, for instance, trade in their vehicle to get a new bike. And we were hoping to generate data through this program since it is new. The other thing is we're getting pushback now from some bike communities. The infrastructure is not there to support electric bikes on the roadway, or at least on bikeways. They don't like the idea of people whizzing by at 30 miles per hour on electric bikes, the safety issues. I would say that this agency had put several million dollars in the past into infrastructure, but once again, we fell short of getting enough data on emission reductions with having bike paths. So we spent a lot on bike paths to nowhere, and we were always trying to link those up so that we would have a more comprehensive and cohesive network of bicycling. And I would say to the board that that option is also available to you if you want to see us concentrate, get the word out that we are interested in projects that would that would help the bicycling infrastructure throughout our three county area. I think that's another area. So that's a legitimate use of AB 2766 funds. Since they are public funds, at the end of the day, I'm concerned that we're responsible. If we're just having a giveaway without any reductions in emissions, then that's problematic for public funds. So that's the tension we have right here. And I just think I thought I needed to bring that to your attention as well.
Glad you did. Thanks, Rich. Director Phillips?
Yeah, I would just, I think it's a good idea, but you have to take into consideration that it's only in limited geographic areas that it could possibly be beneficial. I bought an e-bike. I just wanted to try it out, but I'm out in Prunedale and I don't have the infrastructure there. I can't ride it. I got to put it in my truck and drive to town, to Castorville, so I can get on the path and ride it. And I'm sure there are a lot of sections in Chris Lopez's district is the same way. So it has limited impact. If I got a bike, I wouldn't be helping keeping cars off the road.
Yeah, fair point. Okay, well, I think we've gone back and forth. I see Director Lopez.
Yeah, I just want to say, you know, Rich, I'm comfortable with you using the Kmart as well as Toys R Us since they're no longer in business. So knock yourself out. I don't think we're in too many legal crosshairs and using them as examples as places not to go and pick them up. But I agree with Supervisor Director Phillips on the comments there. And I know that we're headed in the right direction and agree with the sentiment that I heard about making sure that we continue to attempt to focus for the time being on those low income folks that we want to make sure to reduce barriers for, but long run, making sure that we're continuing this conversation in a way that allows us to make sure that access is something that we're focused on throughout our communities. Obviously, for me, the challenge is what Supervisor spoke about distance between communities, and the reality on the ground is not quite what we're seeing in some of our neighboring communities. So I do see additional value there now. It doesn't mean we should invest in it though. And so hopefully someday soon I'll have an e-bike. We will see if we can speed up that pipeline on lithium, but perhaps those should go to cars in the immediate near future along with some silicone chips, but there we go. So anyway, I'm supportive. Just want to make sure that I added my voice to the chorus of support on keeping it focused on the low income for now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good. No, thank you. I think there's consensus, and this is not an action item. I think Mr. Frisbee's been given direction, and if the board's okay, we'll move on to our next item. Mr. Frisbee's air quality summary wasn't enough, we now get an opportunity to hear from Amy. So very excited to hear from engineering and compliance from the year. Amy, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Chairman McShane, and good afternoon, members of the board. Just like David, every year we give a brief sort of update on the previous calendar year. So I'll just quickly go over what we do in engineering compliance and provide you with our activity data for calendar year 2021. So in our engineering side of the house, we evaluate permit applications for compliance with federal, state, and local rules and regulations. Permits are issued with operating conditions. Our engineering team also may be involved in rule development, which is our second presentation of the afternoon. And then we also report emissions annually to the Air Resources Board. So for 2021, this is the activity data, and I'll show in a chart later. It'll be a little bit easier to put this into context of kind of the trends over time. But we received a little somewhat fewer applications this last year compared to 2020. But we did issue more authorities to construct and more permits to operate. So we're doing a good job of keeping up with issuing permits as the applications come in. We only had one agricultural diesel engine registration. We issued 4 Title V permits, and we had 1 emission reduction credit issued. So this is just a chart, pie chart that I was able to make with our new Acela permit database. And this kind of just gives you an overview of the main permit type categories. And as you can see, the largest category of permits that we have are emergency engines. And we have about 3,200 total permits and split up between these categories. So once a permit is issued, it gets transferred over to our compliance team, and the inspectors go out and do inspections, and they're verifying compliance with those permit conditions. And if they find any issues, they will potentially issue a violation. And we also have a team that ensures compliance with the federal regulation for asbestos. And then our inspectors also respond to complaints from the public. So this is our compliance activity data for 2021. And as you'll see in the next chart, we did have somewhat fewer compliance inspections. And this is was an indication of continued impacts from COVID-19. It made it a little bit more challenging for us to be able to do inspections, both, you know, consideration of the safety of our staff and then consideration of the sources not necessarily wanting someone from the outside coming to their facility. But I think we're in a good position this year. Things seem to be much smoother. We did issue more violations last year. So the inspectors did spend a little bit more time having to write up reports for those additional violations. Our asbestos notifications and inspections were about the same as they have been in the past. Same with complaints. We've received about 230 complaints, and that's about the average number that we receive. We had 23 breakdowns, and that's when something at a source for an unexpected reason breaks, and they have to notify us within 24 hours of that breakdown. We had 18 source tests observed, and then we had 2 variances, and those are run through our hearing board. So this is the multi-year trend levels. And the top blue dotted line shows you the total number of permits. And you can see there's been a slight increase over time. Since back to 2013, it was around 3,000. And as I mentioned, it's now about 3,200. So we do have a steady load of permits. The dashed blue line is our compliance inspections. And part of the reason that varies over time is we've had 5 area inspectors sometimes, and sometimes we've had 6 area inspectors. So some of that is related to staffing. And then the 3 at the bottom show you the number of permit applications. The purple dashed line, the green dashed line is the permits issued, and then the red line is complaints. So you can see back to 2013, we do have a steady stream of workload from permit applications and complaints. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you very much.
Looking for any questions for Amy at this point in time? This is not an action item. Okay, so I think we're good. Let's just take a look here. Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Amy. We'll move on to our last item, and that is a, well, let me actually just look into the public. Hang on one quick second. Did you receive anything, Siri?
No public comments.
Okay, just double, triple check in here. Okay, good. All right, we'll move on to our next item, and that's the last item before we go into closed session. That's, again, Amy as well, and it's an action item.
Yes.
Report on. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman McShane. Members of the board, so I'll be talking to you. Rich mentioned this in his director's report, BART, which is best available retrofit control technology. And so I'll start out with a little background reminder of why we're here. And I'll go through the rules we reviewed, what is BART, and then what are staff's recommendation. So AB 617 added language to the health and safety code, which requires air districts to adopt implement a best available retrofit control technology schedule. And this schedule only applies to industrial sources that are subject to cap and trade. And so for our air district, this activity only applies to four sources, and they are all located in Monterey County. And those four sources are LaWast, Era Energy, Chevron, and it's called Cal Energy Operating LLC now, but it was previously Eagle Petroleum. So back in November 2018, the board adopted this BART implementation schedule to meet our AB 617 requirements. And so we have already gone through the process of the first two rules on the schedule. And rule 441 was approved by the board in February 2020, and that was for steam generators, boilers, and process heaters. And then in November 2020, the board agreed that an internal combustion engine rule was not necessary. And so now we've moved on to the third item in our schedule, which is steam-driven crude oil production wells. And in that category, we are considering whether we should revise our rule 427. And so this rule only applies to three of those four sources. LaWast is not a steam-driven crude oil production facility, so this activity would not apply to that source. So just as an overview, when we started to look at this, Rule 427 applies to the steam-driven crude oil production well part of this whole activity. But in looking at this rule, we realized there is another rule, Rule 417, which is storage of organic liquids, which has some similar requirements. And so after looking at this, we thought maybe our best approach would be to create a new rule that would incorporate components of Rule 417 and Rule 427, and then just be subject to the three sources if that was what made sense. So I'm gonna go over now kind of what those two rules entail. So Rule 417 limits VOC emissions from the storage of organic liquids, and that is done by controlling the loss of those organic vapors from the tanks. And this also includes a leak detection component. And implementation of this rule reduces VOC emissions by up to 95%. And then Rule 427 is specific to reducing VOC emissions from the steam-enhanced crude oil production wells. And this rule also has a leak detection and repair program. And this rule also has a vapor control requirement reduction of 98%. And so the two rules apply to different components of leak detection in the process. And as you can see, the leak detection thresholds in both of these rules is 10,000 parts per million methane. And in Rule 417, the vapor control efficiency is 95%. And in Rule 427, it's 98%. And so just for comparison, these facilities are also subject to a state oil and gas regulation. And in that regulation, the leak detection limit is 1,000 ppm. So these three sources are already subject to a more stringent state standard for doing leak detection and repair. And then additionally, the state regulation requires 95% control. And so you can see the control required of 98% in Rule 427 is already more stringent than the state regulation. So just for understanding what I'm talking about when I'm saying leak detection. So leak detection is typically done, is required actually by that state regulation to be done quarterly. And it's done by a person that goes around with an analyzer and they go and they check all the valves and flanges, places where vapors can be leaking. So that is the person on the left. And then on the right is a picture of a tool that is now available. It's called OGI, optical gas imaging. And so this is a camera that can help find leaks. And it's especially helpful in places like at the top of a tank where it can be a little more difficult or challenging to get to the top of the tank. So this helps the person, they can use this camera before they go up there and, you know, double check where those leaks may be coming from. So a BARC definition is an emission limitation that's based on the maximum degree of reduction achievable, taking into account environmental, energy, and economic impacts, each class or category of source. And so for these rules that are related to leak detection, it's a little different. If you recall in our Rule 441 that we adopted for steam generators, boilers, and process heaters, that was a very specific rule that said you must operate this steam generator so that it meets 15 parts per million NOx. And for the leak detection, it's really just an activity that's done quarterly, and they're checking to make sure that vapors are not being lost from places where, like valves and flanges, where they may need to tighten those up. So what staff did was we went and reviewed other air districts that have oil and gas facilities. We looked at the state oil and gas regulation, and then EPA also has an oil and gas regulation. And then there's another state agency called CalGEM, and they are also moving forward with their own separate rule. So we took a look at all of these rules. And as I mentioned earlier, our three facilities are already subject to the state regulation, which requires them to meet a lower threshold of 1,000 parts per million for leak detection currently. So it's already more stringent than our rule. And then it's our understanding that the California Air Resources Board is going to need to update their oil and gas regulation based on comments from EPA. And that rulemaking activity is anticipated to occur this year and possibly into next year. And so with looking at these other agency rules at the state level, federal level, other local air districts, and taking into consideration at the time our BARC rule schedule was adopted, we were non-attainment for ozone. And since that time, as David mentioned, in 2020, we were designated attainment for ozone. And so these leak detection rules are about limiting VOC emissions, and VOC is a precursor to ozone. So with our sources already having to meet the lower threshold of 1,000 ppm, we don't feel we need additional reductions in VOC emissions because we have achieved attainment of our ozone standard. So staff's recommendation is that we do not need a new BARC rule to adjust leak detection and vapor control at the three oil and gas facilities. So our recommendation to the board is to adopt a resolution to approve no further action to implement a BARC rule. And with that, I will take any questions.
Very well put together, Amy, thank you. Let's see, I'll just start to see if there's any directors that have questions for Amy regarding her presentation. I'm looking, I don't see any. Let's go to the public. Don't see anything received, Siri.
Nothing received at district office.
Okay, good. So we'll bring it back and we're looking for comments or a motion at this time.
Move staff recommendation.
Thank you.
Lopez seconds.
Moved and seconded. Lopez, or Phillips, then Lopez. Let's go ahead and call the roll, Siri.
Phillips and Lopez. All right. Director Brown.
Aye.
Director Kosamiki.
Yes.
Yes.
Director Lopez.
Yes.
Director Eskew.
Aye.
Director Phillips.
Aye.
Director Story.
Aye.
Director LeVar.
Aye.
Director Coonerty. Oh, Vice Chair Coonerty, excuse me.
No problem, aye.
Director Friend. Aye. And Chair McChain.
Yes.
Approved unanimously.
All right. Thank you, Amy. That concludes our regular business. We will have closed session and I'll look to Les. Do you anticipate we'll have reportable action?
I do not anticipate reportable action from today. And I sent a separate invitation, Zoom invitation to the closed session. I hope you all got it. If you didn't, let me know right now and I will resend it.
Okay, and just real quickly, we'll see if there's public comment on closed session at this time. I don't see any. So, and Siri, no.
Nope. Nothing okay. Received at the district office.
Okay, so for members of the public, we will be adjourning into closed session. There'll be no reportable action, and directors will see each other in just another minute at the link provided by Les. All right, thank you, Siri. Thank you, staff.
Thank you, bye-bye.